translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu is always transcendental to material qualities, and therefore he is called nirguna, or without qualities. Because he is unborn, he does not have a material body to be subjected to attachment and hatred. So this idea of friends and enemies, right? We're attached to our friends, we hate our enemies. Ittadvesha. Although the Lord is always above material existence, through his spiritual potency, he appeared and acted like an ordinary human being, accepting duties and obligations, apparently like a conditioned soul. So that deals with the last two lines of the verse. So the first two lines of the verse say that Krishna is what? Transcendental. Specifically? No material qualities. Unborn. Avyakta. Unmanifest. And the last two, by his own energy, he does what? Gunam avishya. Manifesting qualities, and he apparently takes on obligations and duties in the world. I remember, what did Krishna tell Arjuna about how he accepts duties? He says, if I didn't accept duties, then what? Everybody would be put to ruination. That was Krishna's answer to Arjuna's argument about if we fight in this war, all the men will be killed and the women will become polluted and there'll be unwanted children. And Krishna said, no, unwanted children comes from people thinking they don't have to do their duty, from people walking away from their duty, which is, of course, very prominent at the present time. So Krishna says, I do my duty, and if I didn't, then the world would be ruined and there'd be unwanted population. Okay, purport. So-called attachment, detachment, and obligations pertain to the material nature, which is an emanation from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But whenever the Lord descends and acts in this material world, he does so in his spiritual position. So Krishna, when he comes here, he doesn't come under the control of his own energy. Although his activities materially appear different, spiritually they are absolute and non-different. So what are some of Krishna's activities that appear materialistic? You think of some of Krishna's activities that appear to be materially contaminated. Taking care of cows as if he has an occupation, as if he has to do something to earn a living. Okay, what else? Dancing with the gopis. That appears not only materialistic, but immoral, which is sort of interesting. Getting married to so many women, having so many children, and Narada Muni is visiting all of the houses, and the children are getting married, and they're doing this ceremony and this ritual. Not only does the Lord engage in household life, he engaged in really like maha householder life. What else? Hunting in the forest. Okay. Saw him go hunting, and he goes hunting with Arjuna also. That's when he meets his wife Kalindi. And they're practicing hunting in the forest. Like in lamenting when Shalva brings the false Vasudeva in front of him and kills him. And Krishna appears to be lamenting like an ordinary person. He also is lamenting when Satrajit is killed by Saradanva. He's crying and he's saying, how terrible, my father-in-law has been killed, been murdered. Okay. So we can think of many other examples. Although his activities materially appear different, spiritually they are absolute and non-different. Thus it is an imposition upon the Supreme Lord to say that he is envious of anyone or friendly to anyone. So he appears like that. He's fighting with Shalva, he's fighting with Jarasandha, right? He kills Satadanva for killing his father-in-law. So he appears envious or friendly, but actually that is not the case. In Bhagavad Gita 9:11, the Lord clearly says, Avajananti mamudha manusim tanumashritaha, which means what? Translation of that verse? Fools deride me when I descend in a human form. Krishna appears on this earth or within this universe without any change in his spiritual body or spiritual qualities. Indeed, he is never influenced by the material qualities. He is always free from such qualities, but he appears to act under material influence. This understanding is aropita, or an imposition. Therefore, Krishna says, janmat karma chame divyam. Janma means birth, and karma means activities. We were talking the other day how generally when people say karma, What do they mean? Usually when we say karma, oh, that's your karma. What do we usually mean by that?
Reaction.
Reaction. We usually mean reaction. The word karma literally means action. And if we're going to talk about karma, vikarma, and akarma, then karma would mean what? If we have talked about karma, vikarma, and akarma, then karma would mean fruit of action, pious, personally motivated action. And Krishna is using the same word karma just in general meaning activities. They are divyam. They are divine. Janma karma chame divyam. Whatever he does, being always transcendental, has nothing to do with material qualities. Evam yo veti tatvataha. Only devotees can understand the truth of how he acts. The fact is that Krishna is never partial to anyone. He is always equal to everyone. He's never partial to anyone. He's always equal to everyone. So that means we're getting different results because of what? Why are we getting different results? Our own actions, our own mentality. Is this true in spiritual life also? Why are we progressing in spiritual life at different rates? Does Krishna like somebody better? It says here, Krishna is never partial to anyone. He's always equal to everyone. So if we're advancing at different rates, what's the cause? Our degrees of surrender. Yes. But because of imperfect vision influenced by material qualities, and G.H.P. was speaking about this the other day, the Atmavan Manyate Jagat principle. I'm influenced by material qualities. I see through that. So therefore, I think Krishna is also has material qualities. Because of imperfect vision influenced by material qualities, one imposes material qualities upon Krishna. And when one does so, he becomes a mudha, or fool. When one can properly understand the truth, that reminds me of one of my students one time who says, why don't you have to raise your hand before you speak? I said, who would call on me? When one can perfectly understand the truth, one becomes devoted and nirguna, free from material qualities. So when one understands this about Krishna, one also becomes this oneself. Simply by understanding the activities of Krishna, one can become transcendental. And as soon as one is transcendental, he is fit to be transferred to the transcendental world. Trakvadeham punar janma naiti mam eti sorjuna. One who understands the activities of the Lord in truth is transferred to the spiritual world after he gives up his material body. Nirgunopi yajo vyakto bhagavan prakrite parahasva maya gunam avishya bada bada katam gataha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu is always transcendental to material qualities, and therefore he is called nirguna, or without qualities. Because he is unborn, he does not have a material body to be subjected to attachment and hatred. Although the Lord is always above material existence, through his spiritual potency, he appeared and acted like an ordinary human being, accepting duties and obligations, apparently like a conditioned soul. You know, if we read through this list of Krishna's qualities, beautiful body, auspicious characteristics, pleasing, effulgent, strong. I'm going to ask you for some of these later. So, ever youthful, wonderful linguist, truthful, talks pleasingly, fluent, highly learned, highly intelligent, a genius, artistic, extremely clever, expert, grateful, firmly determined, an expert judge of time and circumstances, sees and speaks on the authority of the Vedas, pure, self-controlled, steadfast, forbearing, forgiving, grave, self-satisfied, equilibrium, magnanimous, religious, heroic, compassionate, respectful, gentle, liberal, shy, protector of surrendered souls, happy, ever well-wisher of devotees, controlled by love, all auspicious, most powerful, all famous, popular, partial to devotees, very attractive to all women, all worshipable, all opulent, all honorable, the supreme controller. Decorated, enjoying, pleasing, dependable, steady, predominating, meticulous dresser, magnanimous. So those sound like, I mean, some of them are extreme. You know, all powerful, all auspicious. But those sound pretty much like material qualities that we're familiar with, right? You ever met someone who's a meticulous dresser? I've met meticulous dressers before. people who are opulent, people who are honorable, people who are attractive to women, people who are happy, gentle, religious. Those sound like qualities with which we're familiar, does it? Right? So what's a material quality? What do we mean by a material quality? What's a material quality? What makes it material? You know, we also read how the Prahlad Maharaj says how the non-devotees have no good qualities. So you could say a material quality is something that's not really good. How is it not really good? Some places Prabhupada says that the non-devotees certainly have good qualities. But still, we can say that really they don't have good qualities. So how is that? And that is because those good qualities are manifested out of self-interest. How do we know they're manifested out of self-interest? Because as soon as one's self-interest is such that those good qualities no longer serve it, those good qualities will be abandoned. Material good qualities are not intrinsic, but they are a device. They're a means, they're a strategy to achieve something. I want to achieve something for myself. I want to achieve something to please my senses. And by adopting a good quality, I feel that I'm likely to achieve it. We're all taught this, not all, but let's just say everybody here, I'll assume, was taught this as a child. If you want to get along with other people, you should say you're sorry. Like here, Krishna's grateful. You should say thank you. Weren't we taught that as children? Say please, say thank you. Hold the door open for people. Share your toys. Share your food. And what was the reason that our parents and our teachers taught us to be like this? So we'd get what we wanted, right? So we'd be happy. So we'd get along with other people. So other people would like us. So we would get toys, too, if we shared our toys. And we would get food, and we would get friends, and we would get a job. We were talking yesterday with Bhaktivedanta College about how they want to improve their program. And some of the group was talking about how it's important to have good communication skills. Why? So you get a good job. Good people skills. You get along with other people. Not because you care about the other people, but so you'll be hired. Or people want to learn how to get along better in marriage. Why? So their spouse will be nice to them. They're thinking, you know, if I just learn this trick, how to deal with my wife, then she'll be nice to me. If I just learn this trick, how to deal with my husband, then he'll be nice to me. Then I'll be able to mold this person to be what I want. You find this all the time. Okay, well, I acted like this, and I followed everything in the book. I did it, and it didn't work. My husband didn't change, they'll say. So I stopped. I was doing this quality and this quality and this quality, and still he didn't talk to me in the evenings. He just sat around watching television. So I stopped the behavior. I stopped manifesting those qualities because it no longer got me what I want. And there's, I like to think of it as a tipping point. You manifest a good quality up to a certain point. And there's a point at which you'll stop manifesting that quality. I remember for one university course I had, we had to read a number of books on the Holocaust. And one of them, Night by Elie Wiesel, was talking about how his whole family were taken into the camps late in the war. And he saw his mother and sisters burned alive in a pit of fire on the first day. He was a 15-year-old boy. And then he was with his father in the camps for a long time. And at the very end, the Allies were coming into Germany. And so the Nazis wanted to clear out all the camps. They wanted to clear out all the evidence of their atrocities by the time. Of course, they didn't manage to do it, but they were trying. So they were trying to move the prisoners to further and further away from the Allies' advance. And Elie Wiesel talked about being packed up in a cattle car with, overcrowded. So everybody was squished together, and they hadn't been given any food at all for several days. Normally, they gave them just enough food to barely keep them alive so they could work, but they hadn't been given anything, no food, no water. It was the winter. And when the car would stop at a station, the local people would throw crusts of bread into the car. Something like, people, you go to a river or lake and you throw food in for the ducks, like people do that here. Right? And it wasn't enough for everybody, and everybody was starving, you know, freezing cold and they'd been malnourished for months and months, and now they were starving. And people were just grabbing for the food, and they'd push other, you know, they were already so crowded, they would push other people aside. And Ellie saw this one boy who was with his father, another boy who was with his father, who, in the rush to get some bread, pushed his father to the point that his father knocked against the edge of the car and died. I saw, you know, here's a boy killed his own father for a crust of bread. And I remember the professor asking us, you know, what do you think you would do in a situation like that? Because Ellie saw this and he thought, I'm never going to do that. I'm going to serve my father even if I have to starve first. And I wrote down, you know, I said, I don't know. I hope I never find out. You know, I hope I'm never put in a situation where my qualities are tested to that point. But each of us can think we have a point. Now, I'm sure that most of us think of ourselves as truthful, but there's a point at which we'll lie for our own self-interest. I mean, obviously some lies are done because of the austerities of speech. You should be beneficial. You don't, you know, always go to someone and say, hey, you're fat and ugly. You know, there's sometimes when truth is subservient to beneficial for the other party. But there's times when we'll bend the truth for our own benefit. Or, you know, each of us likes to feel that we're magnanimous and that we're fair and that we share things. But there also comes to be a point where we're thinking, hey, maybe there won't be anything for me. And all of a sudden we'll hide something for ourselves. We'll somehow give ourselves the advantage. And we like to think, you know, I'm nice to other people. I treat other people with respect. I treat other people with kindness. But we all know that there are times that we don't. There are times that we become angry, and there's times that we're disrespectful, and often with the people that we're closest to. You know, the people with whom we have an intimate relationship are the people that we're most likely to cross that, to fall over that tipping point and say things to the people that we love and care about that we really don't normally want to say. Or we may do it with strangers, you know, a shop clerk or something. Again, we like to think, oh, yes, I'm polite, I'm respectful, I care about other people's feelings. But if we're aggravated enough, there's that point at which we think, I'm not getting what I want by being nice. Okay, let me not be nice anymore. I'll insult the shop clerk. Right? So many examples like this. You know, we like to think we're responsible, we're clean. Well, if you think about any of these good qualities, that we're religious, that we're gentle, that we're liberal, that we're grave, that we're forgiving. Again, we like to think that we're forgiving, but there comes a point at which we say, oh, I'm not going to forgive that. I can't forgive that. So in each case, there's a tipping point. There's a point at which our good qualities vanish, which means that we don't really have them. They're not really ours. They're just a device. And what we really have is self-interest. That's what we really have. And because we're social animals, you know, we're not shrews. There are some animals that are not social. There are some animals that are loners their whole lives except for, like, brief mating. That's it. Maybe the female taking care of the young. Sometimes not even that. And there are animals that are aggressive even to their own kind. The shrew is like that. You know, they only associate with their own kind briefly for business, and that's all. But human beings are social animals, and as social animals, we do things by collective effort. Just like they say that one of the reasons for marriage in society is that it's much more economical, not only for the people, but for the society as a whole. You know, if everybody has their own house, you end up using a lot more energy. It's actually worse for the environment to have divorce. So we find by collective living, we improve things. If we live just like here, we live in ashrams, which is much more economical than if the temple provided a separate house for each person. Just imagine if each person had to have their own plumbing system and their own heating system and their own kitchen, and it would cost so much more money. So we want to cooperate together. And also we all have, as in human beings, we have social needs. Some of our needs can't be met by operating alone. So we come up with these good qualities We manifest externally the behavior of these good qualities so that we can cooperate and so that we can get our physiological needs met, our social needs met, our psychological needs met. But as soon as we think that I'll be more likely to get these needs met by adopting bad qualities, then we will do so. And that tipping point is a point of fear. That if I tell the truth, I'm going to suffer. I'm willing to tell the truth, willing to tell the truth, happy to tell the truth, proud of telling the truth, or whatever these good qualities, being grateful or being clean or being respectful or being satisfied. And I'm even proud of the quality as long as nothing of my personal life is being threatened. And as soon as something's being threatened, I become fearful. Oh, okay, now I got to lie. Now I have to be nasty. Now I have to be greedy. Oh, I just have to. I have to be practical. You know, it's nice to have these good qualities, but, you know, now I got to take care of myself. So that's material qualities. Material qualities are strategies manifested based on self-interest and based on fear. So Krishna doesn't have any of those. He's nirguna. He doesn't have any qualities like that. Krishna is not artificially adopting some strategy of being grave or respectful to get what he wants. He already has everything that he wants. Now, as Rukmini told him, you already are everything that you want. She says, you don't really possess anything because you are everything. So Krishna manifests good qualities just because that's who he is. That's all. And he always manifests those good qualities. He manifests them regardless of the circumstance. He has no fear of anything. He's not worried about anything. And you can say, well, that's all right for Krishna. But that's true also for the soul who's even at the beginning of liberation. Brahma-bhuta prasannatmana sochitina kansati sama sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate brahma. That Prabhupada says, before you can really engage in develop mature, pure devotional service, you have to be both joyful and fearless. Fully joyful, fully fearless. By the way, you can't be joyful unless you're fearless. Krishna says you can't be happy without peace. Peace, fearlessness, same. There's no happiness without peace. Because if you're fearful, then how do you enjoy anything? And it's not possible. I've given this example many times. You know, if somebody puts a feast plate in front of you, it's got all your favorite foods, you know, exactly what you love to eat. And there's a police officer behind you waiting to arrest you. Says, I'm here to arrest you. You say, how much time do I have? Can I finish my plate? He says, I don't know. I'm just waiting for orders from the office. As soon as they give me the orders, I'll arrest you. How much time do I have? I don't know. 1 minute, 10 minutes, I don't know. How could you enjoy your meal? You couldn't. He said, what do I eat first? Is he going to arrest me with the gulab jamun half in my mouth? My god sister, Rasikya, is in her last moments of life. And one of my other god sisters said that just a few months ago, she had seen Rasikya before Rasikya even knew that she was sick. Just like that, you know, you see somebody and they're happy and they look beautiful and healthy and vibrant, and a few months later they're on their deathbed. It's a fearfulness. We're always afraid everything's going to be taken away, everything that we have. But our natural position is to be fearless, because I don't have anything that can be taken away. All the things I'm afraid that can be taken away, I never had in the first place. They were never mine. They never would be mine. And everything I want, I actually already have. I already have. Yad bhava bhavita diyom anudastataiva samprapi rupa mahimas anuyanabhusha suktayam eva nigama pratitayas divanti. I already have my own house, my own form, my own jewels even, my own furniture, asans. I already have everything in my home. I don't need to worry about having anything in a dream. So we're also at that point of, we also have that fearlessness and joyfulness. If you're completely fearless and completely joyful, why would you ever need to abandon a good quality? Never would need to. Never be necessary. So we also have that same quality of Krishna. Mamai vamso jiva loke, jiva bhuta sanatana. We also have to a small extent all of these qualities, and they're actually ours. They're actually ours. So how do we reawaken our real qualities? We have to, again, come to the point of joyfulness and fearlessness. We must come to that point. As long as we have any fear, then we cannot have good qualities. Sooner or later, we'll give them up. All right, let's meditate on some of Krishna's qualities. Do you have anybody remember some from the list I read that you'd like to meditate on? Oh, you like that one? Oh, I forgot these. The ones I read were all the ones that we also have, by the way. I should also read the ones that we don't have. Changeless, all cognizant, ever fresh, Satchitananda, possessing all mystic perfections. Oh, Barbie, we have those too. Okay, then inconceivable potency, uncountable universes generate from his body, original source of all incarnation, giver of salvation to the enemies he kills, and attractor of liberated souls. Wonderful pastimes, especially childhood pastimes, surrounded by devotees with wonderful love of Godhead, attract all living entities by playing his flute, and an excellence of beauty. Okay, meticulous dresser, that's one of my favorites. We have to go. A person who is very fond of dressing himself is called Lalita, or a meticulous dresser. This characteristic was found in Krishna in two ways. Sometimes he used to decorate Srimati Radharani with various marks, and sometimes when he was preparing to kill demons like Aristasura, he would take care to arrange his belt very nicely. So Krishna is a meticulous dresser in that he knows how to dress other people very nicely. He knows how to dress Radharani really perfectly. And also that he's very concerned about how he's dressed. He really cares about how he's dressed. And it says whenever Krishna goes out, he looks like a dancing actor. Right? He's completely dressed. Shining yellow cloth. He usually has four different garments and all decorated. And it's explained in Brihad Bhagavatamrita that when the young girls are dressing him, I can't remember if it's the morning or the evening. Anyway, when they're dressing him, they're also decorating him. Like sometimes we paint the deity with decorations. You know, people nowadays do this with tattoos, but you know, so they're dressing him, and every time they're decorating him, painting him, Krishna says, "Oh, that's not very good," and they have to take it off and do it again. And then Mother Yasoda comes in and says, "Why are you taking so long?" Or sometimes when they're decorating Krishna, Krishna starts talking about some intimate pastimes he had with them, and they get really embarrassed, and their hands start shaking, and then they mess up the decoration. He says, "Oh, no, that's not very good." And they have to take it off and do it again. And again, Mother Yasoda comes in and says, "What's taking you so long? Why are you taking so long?" Or sometimes when they're bathing him and dressing him also, he says, "Ow!" And then Mother Yasoda runs in and says, "What are you doing? Why are you hurting my Krishna?" But he always likes to be very nicely decorated. And before he kills a demon, he wants to make sure that all of his clothes are just exactly proper. You know? So like before he jumps in the water to chastise Kaliya, first he fixes his turban, then he takes all of his curls and puts them up on his head and puts his turban around again. And just like here, we're dressing Krishna twice a day. So we put him in his day clothes and his night clothes in his unmanifest pastimes. He gets dressed at least four times a day because he likes to go swimming too. So he, you know, in the morning, he gets his bath and he gets dressed, and in the middle of the day he's swimming in Radhakund, and then afterwards he gets dressed again, and then the evening when he comes back from tending the cows, he's all covered with dust. And then again he takes a bath and gets dressed again, and then in the middle of the night again with his evening pastimes, he's out swimming and he gets dressed again. So he likes wearing many, many different clothes. And we know that in Dwarka, when Krishna is swimming with his queens, what does he do with his clothes? What's he do with the wet clothes? They go in the water with the wet clothes, and then what do they do with them? They give it to the performers. Because as Krishna and his queens are swimming in the water, there's these entertainers singing and dancing on the side as they're swimming, and then they give them their clothes. And they only wear them once. You know, they wear clothes once, and then we very rich people on this planet do that. They have clothes made. I don't remember where I was. Somebody's home. Where they had a magazine that had advertisements for $10,000 necklaces. Inconceivable. I just thought, wow, $10,000 necklaces. service we could do for Krishna with $10,000. So these people have, you know, designers. Actually, we have one devotee, I think she's still in Texas, who is a clothing designer. And she was making clothing for President Bush's wife. She was the White House clothing designer. So these rich people, they have their personal clothing designer, and they'll spend $5,000, $10,000 on an outfit, and they only wear it once. They'd never be seen in the same outfit more than once. And it has to be a unique outfit, so nobody else shows up in exactly the same clothes, you know. So what to speak of Krishna? There's so many people, like here we have so many people designing his clothes, so people designing his clothes and decorating him and dressing him, and then he gives away the prasadam clothes. He's very... He always wants to look very first class, even when he's fighting with the demons. Okay, some other quality of Krishna you'd like to meditate on? Artistic. Okay. Let's see what number that was. Artistic is 14. One who can talk and dress... Oh, there we have talking and dressing himself. Uh-huh. One who can talk and dress himself very artistically is called Vidugdha. So, talking very artistically also. Speaking in poetry. You think about the verses of the Bhagavad Gita, other scriptures. This exemplary characteristic was visible in the personality of Sri Krishna. It is spoken of by Radharani as follows. My dear friend, just see how Krishna has nicely composed songs, and how he dances and speaks funny words and plays on his flute, wearing such nice garlands. He has dressed himself in such an enchanting way, as though he had defeated all kinds of players at the chessboard. He lives wonderfully at the topmost height of artistic craftsmanship. So he likes to compose songs. That's one kind of art, isn't it? To write songs. So if any of you have ever written songs or poem, anybody here ever written poetry? Anybody ever written poetry? It's hard, isn't it? We were trying to write some poems for the children's books where you can use only certain words, and it was just, I gave up. It was just impossible. You know, but writing poetry is very difficult, and then what to speak of writing it put to songs. One of my daughter's friends is really expert at that. She's written all these Krishna conscious songs. You know, we have people like Jamini who took Krishna book and put it to music. So Krishna can just compose songs. And thinking about when he was... He's listening to Keshava Kashmiri, who could compose that poem at the speed of the wind about the Ganga. And so Krishna can certainly do that, compose songs. And what to speak of, also dancing. He's a very, very expert dancer. He's such an expert dancer that he's dancing on the hoods of the Kaliya snake. So just think about this for a minute. Anybody know how many hoods the Kaliya snake had? Had 1,000 hoods. And of them, how many were dominant? How many were prominent? 101. Okay. So snake skin is scaly, right? And the snake was living in the water, which means that his hoods would have been very what? Very slippery. Would have been extremely slippery. And he's moving all of them. And then from out of his mouth is coming what? Poison and? Fire? What was the other? Poison and fire. Okay. And what about the water itself? What's the water like? It's poisonous. And what else? Can you describe the water? Black. It was black. It was bubbling. It was actually boiling from the poison. It was very hot. So it was boiling from the poison, and there were poisonous fumes coming out of the water. And then you have the Kaliya's heads, and there's poison and fire coming out of his mouths, and his hoods are very slippery. And then it's not that he's cooperating. It's not that this is some sort of a cooperative dance. You know, like we saw the fireworks dance in Russia, where the different players are cooperating with each other, and they're trying not to burn the other person. But Kaliya was trying to kill Krishna. He was trying to bite him and burn him and poison him. So you're dancing, you know, we admire people dancing on a flat surface that's comfortable and has some traction. So somebody dancing on a slippery surface that are moving, you know, moving slippery surface with fire and poison and boiling water underneath and jumping from one hood to the other. And still Krishna was dancing so expertly that the demigods, and the demigods are pretty good dancers. I mean, we've seen some, everybody here has seen some really, really good dancers in their life. Have anybody seen like a really, really expert dancer? So the demigods are probably 1,000 times better than whatever dancers we've seen, you know, these gymnasts at the Olympics or whatever. You know, they're 1,000 times better than that. And they were watching Krishna dance, and they couldn't figure out what he was doing. They were trying to, and they weren't on snakes, you know, they weren't on slippery snakes and poisonous water spewing fire. And they couldn't keep up with Krishna's dance movements. And of course, it's not mentioned here specifically, but Krishna likes to paint his associates. He likes to paint the other cowherd boys. They decorate each other with minerals. Of course, he's painting the gopis. And then we see all of Krishna's artistry just on this planet. And this is just a lower middle planet. Just a lower middle planet. And just think of like all the flowers. You see those roses there, two-toned roses. So that's Krishna's artistry. Not to speak of ultimate artistry. Okay, we could take one more. Anybody else have a quality they'd like to hear about? Loyal. Okay. Who's loyal? Gentle, respectful, magnanimous, heroic, great, forgiving, caring. I can't find that one. I can find grateful. Can we do grateful? Okay. Somehow I can't find loyal. Okay. Grateful is 17. Any person who's conscious of his friend's beneficent activities and never forgets his service is called grateful. In the Mahabharata, Krishna says, when I was away from Draupadi, she cried with the words, "Hey, Govinda! This call for me has put me in her debt, and that indebtedness is gradually increasing in my heart." This statement by Krishna gives evidence of how one can please the Supreme Lord simply by addressing him, "Hey, Krishna! Hey, Govinda!" The Maha Mantra, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare," is also simply an address to the Lord and his energy. So to anyone who is constantly engaged in addressing the Lord and his energy, we can imagine how much the Supreme Lord is obliged. It is impossible for the Lord to ever forget such a devotee. It is clearly stated in this verse that anyone who addresses the Lord immediately attracts the attention of the Lord, who always remains obliged to him. Of course, we have that same tendency, that if someone says our name, we immediately notice that. Have you been in a group of people where everyone's talking, it's just a sort of blah, 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 blah. You know that funny noise when there's a group of people talking? And if someone says your name, you can hear it. You can make it out. Isn't that, have you all noticed that? People are just, you can't make out any particular words, but if someone says your name, you can hear it. So Krishna's also like that. Krishna even hears his name when people are saying things like Sinarama, you know, or Ramada Inn and things like that. Another instance of Krishna's feeling of obligation is stated in connection with his dealings with Jambavan. When the Lord was present as Lord Ramachandra, Jambavan, the great king of the monkeys, rendered very faithful service to him. When the Lord again appeared as Lord Krishna, he married Jambavan's daughter and paid him all the respect that is usually given to superiors. Any honest person is obliged to his friend if some service has been rendered unto him. Since Krishna is the supreme honest personality, how can he forget an obligation to his servitor? This is a particularly nice quality because, again, you see in this world that our gratefulness is very contingent on whether or not our desires are being satisfied right now. So if somebody did something for me 2 weeks ago and now they're not being nice to me, I tend to forget what they did 2 weeks ago. I tend to say, well, who cares about that? What are they doing now? You know, you see this so many times in difficulties between persons, even, we must say, devotees, where, you know, two people are arguing with each other, criticizing each other, and you say, well, did this person ever do anything nice for you? No, nothing. You know, Prabhupada talks about, well, the man's ready to take sannyas and says, okay, you know, the children are grown up, I'm older, I want to become renounced. I've already given you everything. And she says, what have you done for me? You haven't done anything for me. This is the general tendency. The materialistic person, in an ocean of good qualities, they see the fault. And we often remember the insult and the fault. A person can be our friend for 40 years, and they insulted us one time. We remember that. You know, we forget all the other things that they've done. Whereas Krishna, in an ocean of fault, he's grateful for the good qualities. Putana comes and he says, oh, she's acting externally like a mother. Okay, well, let's take the good qualities. Somebody's going by and say, oh, look at those Hare Krishnas. Oh, somebody said my name. Right? He takes the good qualities. What a wonderful person Krishna is. He just sees the good. Of course, Prabhupada says sometimes Krishna doesn't see what you're giving. He sees what you're keeping back. But that's not critical. That's to help you. That's just like a teacher. If you want to become an expert tennis player, so your teacher, your coach, is going to see what you're doing right, but they better also see what you're doing wrong. They also have to correct, you know, you're holding your arm a little bit this way. You have to do like that. So Krishna also sees what do we need to still work on in order to come closer to him. An expert teacher doesn't just praise, but it's not with a critical or ungrateful mentality. Krishna is always supremely grateful. So this is how Krishna can be equal to everyone. Krishna can be equal to everyone because he has no material qualities. He's completely fearless. He's not worried that I have to be mean to somebody in order to protect myself and get what I need. He's not thinking, I have to be friends with this person and mean to this person and display this quality in order to get my needs met, in order to get what I want. He's fearless. He's completely fearless. And you know what? We can also be fearless. Because that's really what we are. It's not exactly something to attain. Rupa Goswami talks about this in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He says, when we talk about sadhana, which means practice, it's not that we're trying to attain something artificial. That fearlessness is already who we are. It's really, we practice it in order to awaken it, in order to revive it. So we should practice it. Not that we artificially imitate it, but we should work on practicing it. How can I become fearless? How can I just depend on Krishna? Depending on Krishna doesn't mean, okay, I'm serving Krishna, so I'm sure that Krishna is always going to give me my material things exactly the way I think he should give them to me, when I think he should give them to me, how I think he should give them to me. Then I'm thinking I'm God, and God is my servant. God is my gopher, we call them. That doesn't mean the little animal. It means somebody who goes and gets things. You know, okay, now I want this. Go get it. Oh, you're not doing it. Okay, I fire you. So we don't have trust in Krishna like that. He's the boss. We have trust in Krishna like a little child has trust in their parents. Didn't you all fall asleep in the back of the car when your parents were driving? You know, you just trust them. You don't know where they're going. You don't know if they know the way or not. You just trust them. You fall asleep, lie down in the back of the car, and go to sleep. And you get to your destination, and your parents pick you up sleeping, right? Didn't your parents all do that for you? Picked you up sleeping and brought you in, and all of a sudden you wake up, and you're in auntie's house or something like that. You just trust them. You trust my parents are going to feed me. My parents are going to give me clothes. You even trust my parents are going to give me toys. They're going to be friends, and they're going to give me an education. So that kind of dependence on Krishna. Hey, Krishna, I trust that you're going to give me, you're going to take care of all my needs. You're going to take care of, certainly you're going to take care of my spiritual needs. You're going to take care of my emotional needs. You're going to take care of my psychological needs. You're going to take care of my physiological needs. You're going to take care of all of my needs. How you take care of them, when you take care of them, that's your business. And sometimes you'll take care of them in ways that are obvious to me. You know, where we need £400 tomorrow to pay the rent, and somebody walks in the door and hands you an envelope, and here's £400. I mean, that kind of thing Krishna does sometimes. And sometimes you'll take care of them in ways that aren't obvious to me at the time. Sometimes you'll take care of my needs by making me very sick, And so I don't go to the place I plan to go. Instead, I go to another place, and then I end up meeting the right person. And maybe it takes me 15 years or 20 years or 30 years before I see, oh, that was perfect. That time when I broke my leg, or that time when I lost my money, or that time when I had a car accident, or that time when someone insulted me, that was perfect. It was all just absolutely perfect. So it's that kind of trust that Krishna will take care of me, and then one can be fearless. So one can start, you can start with a little thing. It takes some little thing that we're fearful about and say, Krishna, I give this to you. By the way, Krishna is already taking care of everything. Even if you don't give it to him, you don't have control over anything anyway, if that helps a little bit. I don't have absolute control over my health or my money or my friends or, you know, anything that we're afraid about. My reputation, you know. So take a little thing and give it to Krishna. Krishna, you can even try and experiment and give it to him for 3 days. If you're really nervous about the whole thing. If I give something to Krishna, who knows what he'll do? But he's doing it anyway, you know, whether you give it to him or not. So you might as well just give it to him. That's what Palimara said. Krishna's taking everything anyway. You might as well just give it to him. So you take something that you're afraid about and give it to Krishna. Okay, Krishna, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust you with this thing. I'm going to trust you with my money or my clothes or my friends or whatever. You know, I'm going to do my duty. But I'm going to trust you. And then as you do that, you gradually think, oh, this is nice. I become fearless. And when you become fearless, you become joyful. And gradually to depend on, because your faith increases, then depend on Krishna more and more and more and more and more. And then one can really know Krishna's qualities. Very hard to know Krishna's qualities, as Prabhupada says here, that we have this veil. And he said, because of imperfect vision influenced by material qualities, one imposes material qualities upon Krishna. Because we can say, janma karma chume divyam, the Prabhupada thought, well, I understand that. Okay, Krishna's qualities are spiritual. I understand that, but I don't feel liberated. But as long as we have material qualities, we have this veil, and we're perceiving Krishna through our material qualities. Only when we come to the point, as Prabhupada's saying here, only when we come to the point of being transcendental can we really understand Krishna's qualities. Can we really understand how Krishna is transcendental? Otherwise, we're seeing according to our own perspective. Of course, ironically, one of the ways to become fearless and one of the ways to understand Krishna's qualities is to meditate on Krishna's qualities even while we're fearful. Because that helps us to take the step of depending on Krishna. If I think, oh, Krishna is so grateful. He's so artistic. He's such a meticulous dresser. He's so this. As we meditate on Krishna's qualities, I get the faith to surrender to Krishna. And as I surrender to Krishna, I become fearless. As I become fearless, I understand Krishna more. Because I can't really understand Krishna as long as I'm covered by fear. As I understand Krishna more, I get more faith to surrender. And as I surrender to Krishna more, I become more fearless. As I become fearless, I understand Krishna more, and so forth. So we can start with meditating on Krishna's qualities and giving something to Krishna. So thank you very much for putting up with me at the manor for this month. And hopefully, Krishna willing, I'll see you again in the not-too-distant future. Anything I've done that was a manifestation of my lack of good qualities, please excuse me and pray for me that I can actually become a real servant and manifest some actual good qualities. I could take questions for maybe 3 or 4 minutes because I'm at an appointment this morning. Any questions, comments? Yes, Prabhu.